Cool. Wake up.
Yeah, wake up. Welcome, everyone, to the Flight Test Podcast. Eric, you're back.
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
No problem. You did so good on the last one.
Yeah.
We decided to have you back.
So 60 podcasts, we have no Eric, and now we have two Erics in a row.
Wow.
I bet you we're going to go for three.
So what are you doing next week? No.
Actually, 2 weeks from now.
Or, yeah, 2 weeks
Hopefully getting an invite.
Well, Josh, we could get ahead and actually record next week.
But it's so funny when we always get to be like, oh yeah, yeah, today is, by the way, the day we're doing it. So today we're doing this, and there's no like trying to think ahead and dates and stuff.
Yeah, you know, thinking ahead, overrated. Yeah.
And when have we ever been
real
ahead?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, we do have an interview coming up next week, so we will be recording next week.
You don't have to tell us who.
I'm not going to tell you who.
Give us his initial and what he rhymes with. Or she.
Or she, yeah. It could be
An alien. It could be an it.
It's not nice to call aliens it.
Well, if you gave me the name, I wouldn't have to call it.
So we wanted to open up. Actually, we have an interview today.
Do you see how he dodged that?
Seriously. Now I want to know. Is that on your computer?
I'll tell you afterwards.
The computer's right here.
I don't like announcing it until it's...
I'm just looking at a picture of a dropped lipo battery.
Yes, I am. I just posted that.
That's a funny Facebook post.
A couple days before this released, we released a video on aerial photography tips. And Eric also,
he's in that. He's been popping up everywhere.
Exactly. Started in that video. And so I figured we would talk about that a little bit today because podcast is a little bit more longer format. And so we can just, you know, chatter about it.
Eric, you're basically our aerial photography guru.
I try.
You succeed.
It's my passion. That's
so
for sure.
You're gonna bring your turban with a GoPro in it next time.
Yes,
so you
exactly.
You can be the guru. So I figured that we'd just talk about that a little bit.
Is that a Despicable Me reference?
No, maybe.
Oh,
I don't know.
Okay. Just to make sure I was on the same page.
I was thinking guru, where like the headgear, right?
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. I have a headgear.
Yeah, you do, actually. And actually, I think tomorrow you're shooting an episode with Peter and you're bringing your headgear in.
Bring it in.
Eric is like hardcore DIY and functionality, but the funny thing is his DIY components are like top shelf.
I try with that too.
You have a really cool construction hat.
Yeah, it's one of the things. I fly Cinemizer goggles.
Yeah.
And so, not to get all technical, but they've got a wire where they're not wireless like a Fat Shark. The reason I bought them initially a couple years ago, they were the first goggles to be HD. I believe they were the first ones. Don't quote me on that.
I won't.
They were one of the early models to offer HD.
There you go.
And so I bought those so I had some room to grow. Now I can get an HD, you know, Paralynx or DJI Lightbridge or something and put into there and have 1080. But the biggest thing with the wire, I built a ground station and I was tied to my ground station. And so then when I wanted to fly somewhere where I'm, you know, I fly a lot of line of sight hybrid FPV, I can kind of pull the goggles down like a granny and put them on the end of my nose and I can watch out over. And so when you're flying real estate, it's tight. So
do you see the Inspire review? We have a little snippet of Eric in his cool getup flying for, I think, Discovery or someone.
Yeah. So I built a, what is that thing? It's a helmet for like
construction helmet.
Yeah, like a hard hat.
Yeah.
So I put all my stuff in there so I can walk around.
Nice.
But you just recently helped us shoot the AP tips, and that's coming off the end of the Inspire video because a good machine, if you don't understand how to use it, doesn't work very well. And we picked something that's very approachable price point-wise, and that was we went down to the hobby store and got a I'm going to butcher the name. They get just longer and longer, but they just come.
The
QX3.
The Horizon Hobby Blade 350 QX3 AP.
Wow. You know what? Hats off to you, Alex.
Nailed it.
Yeah. One more time. What was it?
The Horizon Hobby Blade 350 QX3 AP.
You know what? Someone's just going to gobble you up for the voiceover. Guy now. Yeah, that. We picked up one of those.
I can't wait for the next version when it's the AP2.
QX3 version 2 AP. We picked up one of those at the hobby store, and that's just a common platform, about $1,000. And if someone's wanting to get something really, you know, crazy with 3-axis gimbal, that's probably Phantoms. Those is where they're going to go.
Yeah, that price point.
And I think it's a couple hundred less than a Phantom, right?
It is a little bit cheaper than a Phantom, and it's not typically our type of thing, but these out-of-the-box, all-in-one solutions are actually becoming pretty impressive with everything. We were impressed with the Inspire, and obviously that's in a different class, but even this little Blade, and even the Phantoms nowadays, like the things you're getting, for example, on this Blade, the gimbal and the camera system alone, I think, is like $600.
Yeah, $500, I think.
$500.
So, and the quality was close to a GoPro 4, probably a GoPro 3, maybe. Mm-hmm. It had no distortion. I mean, it was good quality.
Yeah.
Had no distortion. It was very impressive. But to get all that in one, plus the wireless downlink.
I mean, you're paying $500 for a GoPro. Yeah. This is $500 for pretty much GoPro quality, maybe a little bit of difference. There is no fisheye, which is kind of nice. But you're getting a 3-axis gimbal on top of that, which normally that alone is $300-$400. Yeah. Easy.
So if you take a GoPro midline, $300 for a gimbal, you know, you're at $600. So,
and this is turnkey.
And that's turnkey. Everything just works, and you have lots of control, lots of safety features already there. So it was a good choice, I think, that we, you know, started with that one. And frankly, I liked it with the setup absent of the you call it training wheels. I'm going to use that for the rest of my life. Right. absent from that, where you're flying it in like stable mode, but it doesn't have all the altitude holds and stuff like that. It was pretty darn impressive.
It wasn't bad. Yeah, I was fighting it a lot with when it was still in its like attitude and altitude and all the different holds, and then as soon as you programmed it to kind of be more manual, it did really nice.
It's so weird when you spend, like, Alex, I gotta imagine it would be a nightmare for you, because you spend your whole life going, you know, 60 miles an hour sideways, you know, off of a wingtip.
Well, you saw when I was flying it, the helicopter just looked like it was out of control. Yeah. It's like banking and yanking and going all over the place. But then you watch the footage and it's dead steady. Occasionally you'll just see a boom fly across the screen.
Because Alex is flying at knife edge.
I think I had an easier time than you did even with it.
It was tough. And the transmitter on like DJI's and this Blade, they're not free flowing like a normal transmitter. They pin to the middle, so you're automatically at 50, and then if you push up, it automatically wants to go back to center. So it's like your right stick. It's like two of the right sticks, and I'm just definitely not used to it. And it's not throttle control; it's altitude control. So you're gonna go up. You're going to stay, you're going to hold altitude, or you're going to go down. And you're not actually controlling the RPMs of the motor. So it's definitely a little bit of getting used to. And that's actually how the Inspire was, too. But basically, we went with the Blade because we wanted to get something that somebody who probably doesn't have any hobby experience wants to get into aerial photography. Mm-hmm. This is something that they would probably get, either this or a Phantom or something along those lines, because that's pretty much the most reasonably priced package that you can get. That's going to get you decent quality, you know, cinematography.
It's a pure entry level as well. Mm-hmm. Like for $900,000, you're not going to
$900,000.
We just went to a whole new level.
I bet you that carries a photographer that carries the camera.
I bet you're
that holds the chicken that has the camera mounted on its head.
And when Austin says entry level, we're strictly talking entry level aerial cinematography.
Right.
We're not talking quadcopters or hobby. It's not entry level hobby. Because the pro aerial cinematographers, I mean, they're spending you know, $10,000 on a camera, let alone not even to mention their actual aerial ship.
There's some of those coppers out there, I mean, that are carrying Reds that, I mean, to get a there's Sky Jib and some of these real, I mean, $20,000-$25,000 to get into something like that. It's just crazy.
It's a little on the pricey side.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, but you were gracious enough to share your, what is it, 10 years now you've been doing this? How many years?
I started flying when I was 7-ish, so roughly 33 years I've been flying.
You're like a prodigy from the beginning.
Yeah,
I remember
that. And then I started I built the leading edge to my plane upside down, so I wasn't a prodigy.
No. Sidetrack story. Okay, I just want to mention this because I think the viewers need to know it. Quickie 500, way too big a motor, go.
Yeah, I got it was a Spickler Quickie 500. Mm-hmm. It still had fabric covering on it. This thing was literally from like the 60s.
And those fly off a 25 size motor?
Yeah, I had a 25 on it and I got super bored with it. I put a 60 size motor and we had to balance it with a 5/8 deep well socket.
And what happens when you you do a snap roll with the plane with a 5-inch deep well socket on.
Yeah, it folds the wings pretty fast and comes in like a lawn dart.
And where does the socket go?
Buried into the ground.
In the neighbor's yard.
That's funny.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah.
So he's always been awesome.
But, yeah, so I started my production company about 10 years ago, and I started flying cameras about, I'd say, when this all kind of hit, 3.5-ish.
Yeah.
About the KK1 board, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
So, yeah.
Okay, it's not 10 years, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 10 years for my company. So
10 years for your company.
Doing a video for that long, just not flying cameras.
Remembered a number in there somewhere.
Yeah.
There it is. No, but you've been good, and you shared your knowledge with us, and that video has officially been out because we're talking, it's Friday, even though it's being edited right now, right?
That's came out true. 2 days ago. Yeah. 2 days ago.
And there's so much more I want to share with that video, too. You know, I hope our viewers are, you know, that's kind of just just barely, you know, getting your feet wet with the whole thing. I'm looking forward to some more.
Also, that's a beginner level video.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that, yes, you also have the things we didn't get into, like the post-production.
Sure.
But you also have, you know, an intermediate, you know, which I think the intermediate would be something like an Inspire. Yeah. And then an advanced, you know, would be, you know, something more to the tune of like S1000 or something like
that. Which means we don't have to buy you an S1000 to have you give the tips on it.
What am I going to do now?
Well, the thing to keep in mind too is that when you're doing aerial photography, you're literally combining two professions, which is you could spend your whole life studying about aviation and flying and become a professional pilot, and you could do the same thing with film and videography, design, basically creative jobs like that, and you're kind of taking the two and mashing them together. So it's a very, very, it's a skill that can be very honed, and it takes a while to learn the ropes.
There's many pilots out there that probably could fly circles around a lot of aerial cinematographers, but they're not necessarily going to have the eye for getting a great cinematic image. So,
right.
You know, you could be a great 3D pilot and be able to hover an inch off the ground and not be able to get a good shot. So, you know, it's definitely a skill that has to be brought to the table and honed. And
very cool. And we have an opportunity thanks to you, huh, Austin?
Which is?
Interview.
Oh, yes. I was like, wow, we do?
Coming up in a few minutes here.
I was just thinking the segue.
Yes. Let's go ahead and jump into the interview. This is Eric Chang from DJI. He's the director of aerial imaging there. So we figured he would be a great person to weigh on this topic. Also, something that did happen this week was the incident that most people probably have heard of is there was a quadcopter found outside the White House. And it did happen to be a DJI.
A Phantom.
Phantom.
How many manufacturers, when they heard about that, but they didn't identify, were just saying their prayers, like, Lord,
please not us.
Please don't let it be this.
Please don't let it be the Horizon Hobby QX350 AP3 or whatever.
Yes, but of course it was DJI because of the percentage of DJIs that are out there versus anything else. Yeah, lucky them.
Huge footprint in the market.
And actually, we got a chance to talk to Eric about that and talked about some of his headaches and frustrations with being one of the most popular quadcopter companies, and especially entry-level quadcopters. So, let's talk to Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hey, let me tweak my audio settings. Hold on a second.
Sure, no problem.
Ugh, the arm doesn't quite reach. I got one of those hanging mic setups, which is great.
Oh, nice.
Unless it doesn't quite reach. Okay, does that sound okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
All right.
We have mic envy.
Yeah, major mic envy.
What kind of microphone are you using?
It's a Yeti Blue.
Sure, yeah. Yep, I'm familiar.
USB? Yeah, I went USB because you just plug it in and
you
know, I didn't want to deal with XLR.
Yeah, you don't need an interface or anything.
Yeah, that's nice.
Okay. All right, ready to go.
All right, cool. Just so you're familiar with who's here, we'll just I'm Austin, the guy that was chatting with you on Twitter and email and whatnot.
Right.
And I'm Josh.
And I'm Eric.
And Alex is here too.
Josh, Eric, Alex. Okay. I'm sure I've seen all of you on various videos.
Yeah, the same. You seem to be all over YouTube these days.
Yes, yeah. It's been happening kind of in a strange way, but it's good.
Now, your title is director of aerial imaging, right?
Yeah, I mean, my full title now is General Manager of DJI San Francisco and Director of Aerial Imaging.
Okay, awesome. Wonderful. I think that you and I, Eric, got in touch because of the recent Inspire 1 review that we did. And yeah, I just thought it'd be great to have you on the show and to talk about the Inspire and to talk about DJI in general. I think actually the Inspire was, I think, probably the first DJI content we've done.
Or, I'm trying to think about that. We've used their boards before.
Yeah.
Yeah. On separate multicopters, but I think it is the first multirotor that we've had on the show.
You've probably been a very busy gentleman with that, haven't you?
Taking an aerial photography person who was skeptical and showing them what the Inspire does is pretty much exactly what we do constantly. And I think it's really hard to get a sense of what the product is without actually touching one, which has been one of the big marketing challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I'll link to the review in the show notes here, but obviously we were pretty impressed with it. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of the Inspire and that sort of thing, I thought it'd be interesting. Normally we ask, how people got started in, in your case, aerial photography and radio control, and figured that we'd also, just ask you, you know, just what a typical day looks like for you out in San Francisco.
Okay. I got into radio control fairly late. You know, I was always fascinated by the idea when I was younger, and, you know, even I had borrowed, you know, like an old RC-10 for like a car from a friend, and that was the extent of my experience for the first, I don't know, like 30 years of my life. You know, so I'd always dreamed that I could fly something around or, you know, drive these things around, and anytime I got a hold of one, I would, you know, try to attach a camera to it. But it was kind of early, you know, too early to really be doing something like that in a casual way. So I got into aerial imaging mostly when it started to become possible to assemble from kits, you know, and be successful, you know, without devoting your primary hobby, you know, to RC. So it was, you know, something like, I don't know, 3 years ago, pretty recent. And the motivation was always to get a camera in the air. And, my background is is technical. I'm a computer science guy, but I spent 10 years in the field as a photographer, mostly underwater, you know, so we had a lot of the same kind of technical challenges underwater with an involved hobby, you know, lots of gear, usually small production runs, so a lot of smaller companies in the field. And you were always struggling with equipment. And really, the technical mastery around underwater photography was the first step to, creative productivity. You know, so you had to be a master technically. And that was really the case in the RC hobby until recently. So that's a little bit of an introduction about how I got into aerial. And it was pretty funny because when I first started posting on RC forums, you know, I was really intimidated. And if you go on RC groups and you poke around, I mean, I did exhaustive research. And, you know, when I posted, especially when I started getting published in photography magazines, I would get challenged all the time. You know, people would say, "Who are you? Where were you 5 years ago?" And my only response was, "I was in the field as a photographer." You know, I don't know if that helps, but you know, this kind of intersection of photography and imaging and RC, it just happened so quickly that suddenly our two worlds were thrust together, and it's been kind of beautiful really to see what's happened since.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think you're definitely not alone because we personally see a lot of people that, you know, their singular goal is to get a camera in the air. And that's what brings them to, you know, getting involved in radio control. And, you know, then they start getting into the world of, you know, figuring out, you know, which motors are best and what transmitters are best and what, you know, what cameras are best and that sort of thing. And so I think that we're seeing a lot of that. People, you know, really being attracted to being able to get a camera in the sky and then getting in kind of into the radio control hobby in a reverse way.
That's what happened with Chad Capper. That's how he ended up getting passionate about the hobby. Was just all he wanted to do with his production studio was get aerial photography, and then he fell in love, you know, by proxy to RC Flight.
Yeah, I guess without a doubt, Flight Test wouldn't exist without somebody wanting to get a camera in the air.
There you go.
So that was about, four years ago, 5 years ago?
Coming up on 5 years.
Something like that.
I'd say also Flight Test is really big about kind of getting rid of the dynamic that you just talked about with getting onto a forum
and
feeling like you're, you know, intimidated by all that info, you know, to turn that around and share that wealth of knowledge and to invite people into the hobby in a friendly manner is something that we're really big about.
Yeah, I think it's easy with like something like an RC hobby or even like you were talking about, you know, scuba diving or whatever, underwater photography, anything that entails a lot of knowledge, a lot of learning, and takes years to get to the point where you're savvy at what you do. Even if it's not intentional, I think a lot of times it ends up there ends up being a kind of an elitist atmosphere to those, unfortunately. And kind of that's kind of the reason that we exist. The Flight Test exists in a way because we try to make it as approachable and as friendly, and you know, sharing everything as much as possible. So. That makes total sense. We feel your pain when you log into the forums and try to share ideas.
Well, it's been really obvious that that's what you guys do, and that's one of the reasons I love watching what you do, because it's really informative. It's not elitist, but it's done in a way that shares a ton of information. And you know, we are constantly reminding ourselves that we need to do the same thing. You know, because of course, I have these concentric spheres of community on the internet, and the inner circles are very small, highly technical, and very highly productive. And of course, as you get further and further out, people start to ask the same questions over and over. And you just have to remind yourself that actually not long ago, you were in the same position. Yeah. You know, I was in the same situation just, 3 years ago. I didn't know. I mean, literally, you know, I would spend an hour trying to figure out what a connector was called, because unless you knew what it was called, you couldn't find it.
Yeah.
You know?
You mentioned that you started off a couple of years ago when you could get a kit and get in the air somewhat easily. What was your first RC flight experience?
Oh, I don't know if I can remember. I mean, I actually started by buying those... kind of stabilized coax toys.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm.
Same here.
And so you know, I'd crash them all over the place in the house, and and my wife, who was very unsympathetic, you know, to the hobby at the time, just thought I was playing with toys, and you know, you can see her kind of. Well, I did hit her with one, which she did not appreciate. You know, and I would try to convince her that there was actually a point. You know, no, really, there's a point. I'm going to put cameras on these. It's going to be great. No one's really doing it yet. I mean, of course, people were doing it, but in very small numbers. And so I spent a lot of time just flying these little things around for fun, and you know, learning, kind of. Learning spatial reasoning skills, you know, with a two-stick controller. And I think the first one I owned, I actually bought something that was supposed to work out of the box. And you guys tested this. It was that, what was it called? It was that flying wing, you know, with the quad rotor ring, quad shot.
Quad shot. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, it's still the remnant of that is in the pine tree on the far side of the property.
Oh, yeah. And mine, I did manage to recover, but it did have an unfortunate ending with a tree as well. but I remember hovering that thing and just thinking, this is amazing. You know, it basically just flies, at least in vertical mode. And then I started building kits based on, you know, what I could find online. And very soon after that, the Phantom came out. After that, I ended up, you know, building on the side and tinkering all the time, but really being out and flying Phantom, you know, because it just worked.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of similar stories like that for how people are getting to the hobby now. Well, Eric, if there is such a thing as a normal day for you around the in the offices there in San Francisco, can you just describe what an average day looks like for you?
You know, I just was asked this recently, and I couldn't give an answer because there is no average day. I mean, the average day is being inundated with inbound requests, inbound emergencies. I mean, all the stuff that happens when, you know, multi-copter owners first get one and go out and, you know, 99 out of 100 people are doing amazing things and are being responsible. But then you have the occasional person who, you know, either through ignorance or he's usually not malicious, but, you know, just does something dumb that pulls back our whole industry, our whole hobby. And so, you know, we are fighting fires all the time, but we're also promoting the amazing uses of the products. And then, you know, we're in touch with a lot of the people in the field using our products and feeding that back into the product team to make sure that, you know, we're adapting in the next generation and building products that people who are actually out using it on a daily basis really want. You know, so I would say, I mean, DJI in general is kind of in the middle of this transition from hobby to mainstream and commercial. And you know, we would love to maintain a relationship with hobby because it's so important. At the same time, the numbers coming from the mainstream audience are huge. And this is what we were talking about, you know, seeing on the forums a lot, is this kind of clash between people who just want to go out and fly and get something and people who are really building something at home and you know, want to be in the hobby forever.
Mm-hmm.
So, a typical day is doesn't really exist. And that's one of the things that is, I think, so exciting about this industry. You know, it's changing almost literally on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we can definitely relate to not having a typical day. Sometimes, and actually I think we can identify with putting out fires, both literal and figurative sometimes. I think that's awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. And to touch on kind of what you said about, like, you know, just kind of the balance between people that are using the technology for great things, and sometimes, you know, we all see the news stories and all you can think of is, you know, come on, guys. You know, like,
No.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Let's keep a good thing going here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know we wanted to talk about this, especially when we talk about Inspire. But, you know, one of the things that we are proactively doing is trying to build some real safeguards into the technology. And, you know, we saw kind of first attempts with the FlySafe program, you know, no fly zones around airports or at least restricted altitude. You know, it's kind of a hybrid model. And, you know, we just pushed out, well, we put a press release out today, which has been picked up by the Wall Street Journal already, about the next phase of this, kind of restricted flight. And this is going to be an evolving topic basically forever, because everybody's trying to figure out how we can all use these responsibly. And it would be great if the technology helped you to, you know, encourage you to fly in a responsible way. So in addition to flight restriction areas around airports and now around this, you know, around DC. Around
Washington.
Around Washington, DC specifically. I don't know if you've noticed this, but all of our latest products are by default limited to 400 feet AGL.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just so we can be respectful and kind of try to honor these FAA guidelines that have been around for a long time.
Yeah, I got that press release early this morning. I was actually reading it to Josh.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting. And I could see how different people could come at it from different perspectives. I mean, me personally, I'm a huge fan of it. You know, it, like, actually having you know, firmware restrictions on what you can do, what you can't do. It's just like any other technology or any other hobby. You have to define the sandbox.
Yeah,
and right. Unfortunately, that sandbox has not been 100% defined.
And one of my concerns is, especially what we experienced with the Inspire, and I know I talked about in the podcast in the review, is if the government defines the sandbox as America, you know, what does that mean for... Does a flash update go out to the Inspire that someone spent $3,000 on, and does it ground your Inspire from working on your own private property? That's a real concern.
Right. Yeah, yeah, it is a concern, and I think, you know, we are also trying to figure out what the best way is, and I think, you know, we'll react in a way that we think is reasonable. I mean, I think, for example, in the case of pushing no fly zones around, you know, one of the things that has already come up is, what if you're in a cage or an enclosed environment and you happen to get GPS signal? You know, are you grounded? You know, these are things that we're still working out. I mean, we're all in the very early phases of all of this. And, you know, the DJI's goals are really to ensure that the industry is successful in the long term. And, you know, that should be all of our goals. You know, it doesn't do us any good to assert these rights or, you know, just because of... you know, unknown, a lot of unknowns going on, in the short term, in the next 6 months, and shout, and only to have things shut down in the longer term. You know, so this is not to say that we're going to react in a knee-jerk fashion and just restrict things because someone says we should. I mean, the 400-foot limit, for example, is a default, but you can override it because it's not illegal to fly above 400 feet.
Yeah.
You know, so we're trying to do this in the most responsible way, and hearing from folks like you and your audience is really important for us. And, you know, while we not may not be able to respond to everybody, it's basically impossible to respond to everybody. You know, we're reading everything. So, you know, keep the feedback coming.
I know one of the things that we always encourage people to do is just because you can turn it on and you can fly, usually people can go through the path of learning about RC flight. And once they fall in love with that, or once they at least get competent with that in general, they'll respect the boundaries, because then they really realize what the technology can do. And a lot of people are so passionate about just going up and getting some amazing footage. And by the way, the Inspire got some amazing footage. It was incredible.
Speaking of that, if you don't mind that I ask you, I love the aerial cinematography aspect of things, and I know you do that type of work as well. And I don't want to shift gears, obviously, or take light off of the safety, you know, talk. But at the same time, I've got some really, you know, some questions about the Inspire, if you don't mind.
Sure.
When they started developing that, you know, how far into the process was it before the very first prototype flew? I mean, was this a home run type of a project, or was there different designs along the way, if you can speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, we are working really far out, and you know, those people in your audience who know anything about DJI will know that we're very R&D oriented, and you know, that really comes from Frank, who founded the company. Who is he's like a R&D guy who had dreams of flight, you know, from when he was a toddler, basically. So, we're working way out. We have about 500 engineers, working at any given time.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. And, the Inspire 1 was a long project. I mean, I remember seeing, very early prototypes kind of, you know, back in July and earlier. So I don't want to comment too much on the internal development process at the company, but it was a long time coming. And you know, one of the things that I've pointed out in the past is that when you see products being released by companies, especially companies like DJI, I mean, let's take Lightbridge, for example. You know, Lightbridge came out, it was $1,400, which many people thought was insanely expensive. But of course, you know, HD wireless transmission basically didn't exist in that price point at the time. And
sure.
So I really, the point is not to look at any one of these technologies or products in an isolated way. You know, everything we're building is infrastructure, and it is nowhere more obvious than in the Inspire 1, you know, which, you know, if you look at the feature set and the components, kind of builds everything we've been working on into a single ready to fly unit.
Yeah, and I think that was my biggest shock when I first got this thing out of the box. When we did the episode, that was my first time ever seeing one in real life. You know, I've been doing cinematography with aerial vehicles for a couple of years now, and I've always used DJI stuff. I have flown nozzle boards and Wukong boards that's pretty much all I've ever flown, really. You know, it cost me, you know, kind of speaking all the features, I guess, that the Inspire puts into one package was, you know, one of the biggest shocks. I spent close to, I mean, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 between buying a Zenmuse gimbal for a GH3 to get, you know, a Wukong controller. And, you know, by the time I outfitted my copter to do really decent cinematography work, I mean, I'm $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 in. And the Inspire comes out with HD downlinking and all this stuff that we don't even have at a $10,000 price point. So that was, you know, that was really a shocking surprise in a really positive way.
Right, right. And we've seen this kind of divide in the response to the Inspire 1. You know, people who are into aerial cinematography and who have been building these rigs for a long time have exactly the response that you've had, which is that you literally cannot build it for this price.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we have a lot of people saying, well, I could just take a Phantom and add this and this and this. And it's, to be honest, it's been a little frustrating, because how do we communicate to this audience that, no, actually, there are a lot of things about this that are very new. It's just that maybe they don't apply to everybody. You know, it's the target audience for the Inspire 1 is not everybody. You know, sure. The target audience really are people who are out trying to capture something in a specific way with an aerial vehicle. And, you know, when you get into it and you talk about all the features that have bundled together into a single unit, it's pretty hard. It's actually very difficult to try to reproduce that.
Well, they say if you try to create a product for everyone, you end up creating a product for no one. So,
yeah. Right.
Well, if you think about a professional photographer, you know, the camera they carry to use for work, I never knew that lenses cost well over $1,000. If you think about
starting out for decent lenses, you're looking at least $1,000.
Yeah, and you guys have something that works phenomenal that flies. So someone right. that needs to do that, whether it be a realtor or something on a professional level, that's a really good option. I would take this out and use it to, like Alex does with the race quads and stuff, go parallel with the plane. That's not what this is made for.
Race through the woods.
Race through the woods with an Inspire. That'd be a good episode, actually.
It's hard not to want to race it, though, because it performs well. Yeah.
Well, that was the real shock. I've seen a lot of, like, the Phantoms and stuff, and when they have the gimbal on it, they're a lot more bobbly. This thing was locked in. It looked like one of Eric's dialed-in machines that was really, you know, built to be flown by a pilot. And that's the one thing I thought was just exceptional. It was intuitive, but yet it wasn't crippling with its what do you call it, training wheels?
Yeah. Yeah, when you fly in Addy mode, like on a Phantom, it just, you know, there's only so much performance you're going to get out of a machine like that. And then the Inspire comes along, and it's doing amazing work, and it flies like, you know, a helicopter that costs a lot more.
Yeah.
My wife was mad, by the way. I spent all this money on a machine 2 years ago, and this thing comes out and does more for a fourth of the price.
I think we got a deal going with Eric where he's going to be able to use it whenever he wants.
And you know, we've been listening to the audience too. The smart device based configuration, you know, like adjusting expo and, you know, the speed of the gimbal and all these sorts of things. You know, we've heard repeatedly from folks who are out doing, you know, actual cinematography with the devices. So that's all built in, and I've been really impressed at the speed at which our development team gets to that stuff. You know, we give feedback obviously all the time, and then before you know it, it's in the app, or sometimes even before we ask for it, it's in there.
What's you know, obviously we've seen some pretty funny YouTube videos where things weren't calibrated properly and you know, if someone flies it into a garage, but there's going to be eventually a crash. What's the way, and this may be out of my ignorance, do you guys have a place to fix them? One of my biggest concerns was looking at the gimbal, you know, when you go down, if you hit something or snagged a branch. Is there a service you guys provide, or how do people go by fixing these?
Yeah, we have a big support center in Los Angeles, and support has, you know, from everyone I've talked to out there, gotten a lot better. You know, it's hard for us to get we look at statistics all the time, you know, but to really get a pulse on what people think is can be challenging, because, you know, the people who are not happy tend to shout the loudest, you know. And but for the Inspire 1, since it is a higher end product, we have 24-hour support. You know, with 1 hour response time. That's the goal anyway. And all of the support happens out of the LA office. The other thing is, you know, with a modular camera and gimbal, in theory, you can just swap it out with a new one. And, you know, internally we do that because when we're testing, you know, a prototype may go bad and we literally just put another camera on it. So the goal in the longer term is definitely to scale up production so much that, you know, you could have backups and you could get a replacement part essentially immediately, you know, specifically when you're talking about the camera and gimbal. And I think, you know, part of what you're getting at about the rest of the Inspire 1 is, yes, in an integrated design, it is harder to just open it up and swap out an ESC, for example, and might be impossible for most people, you know, even in the hobby community. So support is really important. We are, you know, we're definitely dedicated to great support as a long-term goal. But of course, as we scale up, you know, it is actually really hard to build that into, you know, to build in a great support system pretty much instantly as we scale so quickly. So yes, it is something we're working on really hard. We're listening to everyone who's talking about it online. You know, keep giving the feedback. You know, I just keep saying, we need the feedback, keep giving it to us. Of course, in a productive way is great, much more effective than maybe some other ways.
Sure. For the, you know, obviously the multi-rotor hobby, and DJI is a great example of this, is growing at you know, an, just an insane pace. What do you see as the you know, the future of this industry, and what opportunities and problems do you think that that poses?
Well, the you know, this industry is in a state right now of insane growth and rapid improvement in product. You know, so if you look at the products, you know, a year or two ago, they feel very old. You know, they're almost unrecognizable compared to what we're flying now.
Sure.
And that curve is just, I mean, we're going to be on that curve for a long time because everything is so new in this industry, and you know, we have a long way to go. And of course, new industries are opening up constantly, like the entire kind of commercial industrial world, you know, which is already running pretty smoothly in many countries, not so much in the U.S. And so I think the challenges are really that for the first time we have something that might fit into, say, Department of Transportation world in terms of regulation that is moving so fast that regulators cannot hope to keep up with it if they try to address things on a very specific scale. So, you know, if they're trying to address specific models, specific frames, I just don't see that working. You know, it has to be a generalized regulation model, you know, like maybe they have in Canada, that, you know, relies on enforcement, of course, which is something we don't have here yet, and also just a reasonable set of rules that are communicated by folks like you, you know, manufacturers like us, so everybody knows. I mean, if you look at anyone who's doing RC as a hobby, let's say 10 years ago, like everybody knew what the guidelines were. You know, those are just, it was just standard knowledge, and that's, we really need to get to that point. Use common sense, but being able to access that information and having it be part of the standard language is something that we should all aspire to.
Do you have any ideas on just kind of the education standpoint of it? Because I think that one of the reasons that, you know, just standard guidelines were so common knowledge, you know, even, you know, 5, maybe 10 years ago, was that because most people that got into flying something, remote control, you know, got into it from somebody else. You know, somebody introduced them to getting into the hobby or whatnot. And now you don't really need anybody. You know, you can go to the store and you can just, you know, purchase, you know, 10 different, you know, 20 different products.
Right.
Even places like Best Buy now carry, you know, different varieties of multi-rotors. And so what do you think that a good way to move forward with that is?
Well, I think first of all, having a set of rules would be great. we're sort of missing the fundamentals here, so it's really hard to think about how to go forward. But I think, you know, certainly if you're using something commercially and you're in a certain weight class, like those rules should just be, I mean, we should all know about them. You know, if you want to use one commercially and you're above some weight, there should be a certification process in the same way that you can't just get in a car and drive. You need to be licensed. I'm not saying that, you know, licensing needs to come necessarily, you know, from a federally controlled program, but, you know, the program could be federal, but you could kind of bless associations to, you know, to certify. You know, there's just kind of the way the whole aviation industry that has been working, you know.
That's similar to how Canada, I believe, does it, right?
Yes, that's right. And in the UK, and there are lots of other examples. So, you know, I think we need role models in this industry. And, you know, in the same way that everyone gets into, or you pointed out, got into RC, you know, if we see drones or multicopters as, you know, sort of a standard part of how we operate in industry, it will become really apparent, I think, to hobbyists, you know, how we should behave. And I think, you know, classifying them is going to be really important because, you know, as I've constantly pointed out in regulatory meetings, there is essentially a full spectrum of product from, you know, 1 ounce now sort of autonomous flying things to, you know, pretty much things that are as heavy as you can imagine. So where do you draw the lines and, you know, what is a toy? And if I fly an airplane, paper airplane outside and someone gives me $1, is that illegal? You know, these are all things that we need to answer. And, you know, I think we're looking to the FAA and we're looking to work with regulatory bodies, and we have been, to establish what those rules look like.
So as far as aerial cinematography goes, I keep going back to that. That's my passion, so I hope sure. You don't mind. when I'm flying, like, you know, it was funny because I talked about in the review of the Inspire, you know, I wanted to find something wrong with it. You know, this turnkey out of the box has got to have a fail point or so on. And to my surprise, I didn't find one, which made me really happy. You know, like I said, I've been a
except big, the on-off button.
Well, yeah, maybe that was ours in particular, but I got flamed pretty hard on the internet about that. They're like, you can't even turn it on. You know? But, you know, I know when I'm flying that, you know, having a copter that is, you know, completely reliable and turnkey is really, really important. You know, I've been out on some shoots with Discovery Channel, and I know, you know, when we fly something for a client, there's no room for failure. There's no room for something to not, you know, be easy to fix, easy to pack up and travel with and so on. And, you know, to my liking, the Inspire really brought all that kind of together in one package. The biggest thing that I've had, you know, I have a 1,000mm hexacopter, and traveling with that thing is just a nightmare. It's so hard. And I mean, it's foldable. I mean, I did the best right. I could when I did the build to make it easy and to repair in the field and that sort of thing. But having something turnkey to do aerial work, you know, takes your mind off of all of the things that can go wrong and just allows you to be creative and that sort of thing. So, when I'm out flying, I guess one of my questions for you is I like to use, you know, objects that are close to the helicopter as kind of like foreground elements to kind of show life to the footage and add some movement to it instead of just flying over stuff. Right. You know, when you're flying and doing that type of work, what types of things do you look for in the way of movement and framing and so on?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. You know, it's you need to have enough, you know, diversity of objects in the frame or subjects in the frame to show that the movement is something that's in three dimensions, you know. And if you're sort of at high altitude flying forward, you know, it's, you might as well have, you know, a painting under you that's just moving. And so I think, you know, you're talking about sort of showing life or movement in the shots, and that's exactly it. I think, you know, reveal sorts of movements, you know, where you have an object in front that's obscuring something spectacular, and then you sort of slowly reveal that actually there's something even more, there's something amazing behind it.
Sure.
And, you know, the kind of classic first-person shooter circle strafe, you know, those are...
Yeah, yeah.
Those are good. That's a really good move to master. And, yeah, so, I mean, I think it's really, in addition to translating the aircraft around, you really have to have control of the camera itself, and I know that we're, you know, that's the reason we added that second the second remote to allow a cameraman to help. But even as an individual pilot, you know, I think people have been successful in at least controlling pitch during movement and being able to do really complex camera movements as an individual. But I think in general, low altitude stuff is where it's at. You know, the high altitude stuff is maybe interesting because no one's seen it. I mean, except from manned aircraft, and so it's all new. But it's much more interesting to, you know, fly through a forest, for example, than to fly way above the forest and look down.
It's an intimate shot that you can get, that you just, a perspective you don't get from anything else.
Yeah, yeah, and also the, you know, the unexpected. You know, if you're shooting with a multi-copter in a way that might suggest that you're using a land camera, and then suddenly it's beyond reach of where anyone could be holding it, you know, the audience is then left thinking, wow, how'd they get that shot? And, you know, we've seen this in big budget movies for a long time, and I'm always left wondering, well, was that in CG? Did they actually do it?
Sure. You know? There was a music video, and I can't remember what it was called. It was just released maybe 6 months ago. I don't know if it was done in Japan or somewhere where they had a copter. They were actually holding on to a copter with a gimbal, and they were filming the music video on the ground. And they had these little scooters that Honda, are you familiar with that?
No. Yeah. Okay, go.
Yeah. And they did this thing where then the copter lifts. So, it, you know, leaving the viewer just kind of mind blown with what just happened.
So, right.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we have handheld gimbals like the Ronin, and we did a one shot, in LA where, you know, passed it through windows and did all sorts of weird things that, and then put it on a crane. You know, it's always those moments of uncertainty about how it was done, you know, and that I think our the audience is like.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the long range and the high altitude stuff is probably going to be decreasingly popular. I think it's especially from an entertainment perspective, it's really hard to make a long range flight interesting. You know, for specifically what we do.
The hobbyists are typically the ones who are really into the hobby are the ones that really enjoy long range, and it is fun, and I've done a bit of it. The main reason why flight test doesn't do too much long range is because, one, most of the time it's illegal, but mm-hmm. also that kind of thing doesn't really come across very, very good on camera.
Doesn't communicate well at all,
know?
Yeah.
You can just put a GoPro right. on a Cessna and, you know, slow it down.
Yeah.
And we're definitely not looking for like any kind of exclusive scoop or anything here, but
yeah, we are.
but speaking of that, I know you know, DJI has kind of been, you know, basically dominating kind of the amateur, prosumer, professional area photography market. Do you see DJI in the future kind of branching out? I know that, like, for example, like the racing quads are becoming extremely popular. Do you see DJI in the future diversifying to kind of other segments, or staying mainly an aerial photography company?
I mean, we've already branched out in that, you know, we're releasing stabilization tech for the ground, and sort of thinking about how people might want to use imaging technology, you know, that can cross those boundaries, you know, so. One of the things we showed at CES was a handle for the gimbal in the Inspire 1, you know, so you can sure. take the camera and gimbal off and stick it on a handle mm-hmm. and run around. And I mean, you've probably seen this too, but we see people all the time carrying Phantoms, like, and using the gimbal because it just happens to be attached to a Phantom.
Yeah.
So they cut off three of the arms.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we're expanding in that direction. And certainly in the aerial market, we will be branching out in sort of all directions you can imagine, you know, bigger and smaller and for other other purposes. But I think they're always going to have cameras, you know, because even the small racers, you know, except for some isolated groups and hobby, it's still pretty much FPV. You know, it's basically the desire to be pod racing.
Sure.
And I think, you know, as that becomes more of a real market, we'll be looking at it really carefully. I don't know, we're already looking at it. You know, we're certainly aware of everything that's going on. And I participate in that stuff, you know, kind of as much as I can. Even lack of time, unfortunately, doesn't give me much time to practice. But,
sure.
you know, we fly locally with a group here that includes, you know, Hovership and Charpu and, you know, those guys. And
oh, cool, yeah.
And it's awesome to see them take these little 250s and scream through trees and around tracks, and you know, I'm often up in the air with an Inspire filming it. but yeah, they're all really interesting, and you know, FPV racing I think is has the potential to be something that could be pretty big, and it's great to see the hobby community really embracing it and pushing it forward.
It's a good practical application to FPV beyond aerial photography.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Keeps it down low and safe. Now, has Charpu asked you to flip the Inspire?
Oh yeah, we get a lot from. Actually, the troublemaker is not him. It's Pablo. You know.
Oh, Pablo, yeah.
Barrier crusher, yeah, yeah. He's always trying to get us to do crazy stuff. And I remember taking a prototype Inspire up, and he flew his 250 way too close. He was doing circles around it. I was telling him, you know, I have exactly one of these. Right now. We have to do a lot of pre-imprint demos, so let's calm down a little bit.
I have a very precise number of these, and it is one.
Yeah, that's right.
I've just started dabbling in the race quad thing, and everybody is, you know, got their favorite board, and I show up to the field with a NASA on my racer, and I get made fun of quite a bit for that. But what's awesome is it as a racer, if you're doing laps or, you know, pod racing with another copter, it's fantastic. It is locked in. It flies amazing. It's, you know, it's not going to do loops and rolls as fast as some of the other boards, but it's right. Yeah, I'm going to leave it on there because so far it's ripping pretty good.
You were going quite fast with it yesterday.
We did a media event at CES, which was called Drone Rodeo. It was a bunch of companies kind of friendly in the space getting together and helping general, you know, like mainstream media to understand that this is fun, you know, as sure. well as being really, really useful in many industries. It's a lot of fun. So we took Phantoms in GPS mode and we had them race like media versus media. And, you know, we had a leaderboard and it was pretty amazing to see the success rate, of something that's, you know, has position hold as the default, you know, yeah. You let go of the sticks. And so we had very few crashes and people had a lot of fun, I'm just staring out of the front of a Phantom in a racing environment. So even something that, you know, is actually fairly slow and, you know, but everybody, it's like people who race Miatas, you know, everybody is starting out with the same gear and nobody's faster than anyone else, you know, unless they have skill.
Yeah, sure.
So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I watched quite a few of those videos. It looked like you guys were having a good time.
Yeah.
I got to do something kind of crazy with a Phantom once. We were filming a commercial, and it was to take a sub sandwich from a gas station out to the customer in a new way. This was actually like 2.5 years ago, but it was so funny because we outfitted this Phantom with this big, huge thing to carry this sandwich. And like, I was so shocked. It actually lifted this like 7-inch like sub sandwich that was loaded down, and it was awesome.
It was a Blimpy?
No, it was Get-Go.
Get-Go.
Yeah.
That was funny. I remember watching that.
good times.
Yeah, I've seen people, and unfortunately a lot of times people don't understand the technology. They're the ones that actually, and it's not on the private sector, it's in commercial. I saw where they were trying to demonstrate carrying a mistletoe over Christmas. Was it TGI Fridays?
Yeah, I think it, yeah.
And it's like, really? You really, you know, and unfortunately that gets the media where it's not even the private sector that's doing things to put a bad name on it. It's, you know, people that are looking to use it as a gimmick to promote their own business that don't fully understand it. And I think as time goes on, quad racing and great platforms like the Inspire, which I'm sure you saw the review, I really wanted for the price point to dislike the thing. But when you do break down all the price points and all the things you're getting with it, it's hard to beat. It really is. I'm a DIY nut, but that is a lot of bang for the buck. And it's not for everybody. But the people that are going to use it as a tool, I don't think would have any issue throwing down that money gladly.
Right.
And we're ordering a couple more batteries. Our intention was to review it, and then we're going to sell it. And it's part of our fleet now.
I was going to go buy one. Awesome. I don't have to now. So. Right,
yeah. So it's good stuff.
Yeah. And you know, for professional shooters, if you don't need... right now, anyway, if you don't need a big sensor and the picture from the Inspire is suitable, there's some comfort in knowing that if something really goes wrong on set, you can overnight one or run to a store and buy another one.
Yeah.
You know, and that's that hasn't really, we haven't been in that situation before, you know, here because there's so much DIY and, you know, by necessity. And I actually think the DIY stuff will go on, of course, in the high end and in heavy lift stuff. But you know, I've always been confused by why we try to stabilize land cameras. You know, why are we why are we spinning around a metal frame and a grip and a viewfinder and, you know, all this stuff?
Yeah,
because we have to, I guess. But I think really we don't have to. You know, I think this size, you know, 600mm frame, that kind of size actually is really, really powerful and can lift a lot of very useful imaging equipment, and it's just that the imaging gear has to be redesigned and integrated.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I know the Red company made the new Dragon camera has carbon fiber implemented into it now to kind of lighten the camera up. I know we are always trying to lighten our copters and, you know, have more milliamps and so on and so forth. But, you know, as you're saying, as the cameras start to get lighter and start to be used purpose built, you know, for that industry, I think that's going to increase a lot of ability.
Right. That's a perfect example. Yeah.
For the Inspire, in the future, do you see more like interchangeable cameras for different options for people that are looking for something more specific, or is that gimbal and camera setup going to be pretty much the standard?
Oh no, I think you can expect a lot of changes. I mean, one of the features of the Inspire 1 is that modular connector, and this is another thing to point out. You know, I think in the past, if you look at all of the products DJI has released, you know, they've all been indicators of what's coming.
Sure.
You know, the original Vision was smartphone integration and integrated camera, and the Vision Plus were, you know, small light gimbals, and now we're, if you just look at what's new in the Inspire 1, this is all starting point. You know, it's not, shouldn't think of it as the final the end game. I mean, it is a flagship product, but you know, that modular connector is really important going forward. And really the idea is that, you know, one camera, one lens is not really enough for a tool set that can do a lot more. You know, we would love it. I'd love to have you know, an arsenal, essentially, like in the same way that you might have a, you know, five lenses for a particular shoot, I can imagine having a bunch of different cameras.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it will take time to get there, you know, so I think the Inspire 1 as it exists today is, I mean, for me anyway, it's been really useful and fun, but I think going forward you'll see a lot more coming out.
Well, you're helping us understand what your 500 designers and engineers are doing, so. Yeah, awesome. Well, Eric, you've been extremely generous with your time. I know we've gone a little bit over, but I just want to thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your thoughts and opinions with us.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, and I'm so glad you guys are out there doing what you do, because it's going to be, I mean, it has been really important for the industry, especially as it's changing. You know, you're sort of a voice of reason, so thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much. We definitely appreciate that.
I look forward to hopefully talking to you again, too. I'm sure you guys have a lot of things coming down the pike. We'd love to have the opportunity to unpack those things.
Sure, anytime. I'm up for it.
Great.
Awesome.
Thank you, brother.
Great talking to
Take
you.
Take care.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Can you believe how good he sounded?
He sounded
That is the
awesome.
Best phone interview
microphone
ever.
Microphone ever.
Holy cow.
And actually, I know exactly what microphone he's using.
It's just a USB?
Yeah, it's just like a USB microphone. And so he's doing something right with the room he's in or whatever.
I just broke my pop filter 5 minutes ago.
I was
trying to adjust it, and I broke it.
Saw you struggling over there.
With it.
Yeah.
No, the dancing little, with it. The bendy arm wasn't working. Yeah, what a nice guy. Honestly, that was really impressive. He has a heart for, obviously, aerial photography first, but it's cool to know he's still passionate about race quads and a lot of stuff in the industry.
And he gets to fly with Sharpu.
That's true.
Yeah. We're going to get
that. Maybe we need to have Sharpu on the podcast.
I think we're already planning to.
Is that so? You got all kinds of surprises.
Yeah. Oh, is that possibly what's next week?
That's actually not next week. And I actually haven't scheduled anything, but we are supposedly going to be with him in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I guess nice. What's the name of that, the meetup that we're going down to?
CFL 2015.
2015 CFL. It's a FPV meetup in, not Sarasota.
It's in
Florida.
It's somewhere in the great state of Florida.
Yeah, so we're going to be down there. If you guys are in the area, we'd love to fly with you, hang out with you. I believe we're going to be there most of the day on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep, we're going to be there.
We're going to meet up with nice folks at GetFPV.com, right?
GetFPV, Lumineer.
It's in the actual event, I guess, is in Leesburg, Florida.
Leesburg.
It's the CFL FPV 2015 meet.
It's going to be warm.
You're going too, right, Eric?
I hope so.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Is that news to you?
Did you
guess
say
what? You're going.
I think we talked about it, but I didn't know it was confirmed, so look at that.
Well, you said you wanted to meet Sharpu.
I do. Well, it's funny. I actually friended him on Facebook, and he accepted, so I feel honored.
Ooh.
Nice.
So, yeah, I can't wait to get to chat with him a little bit more. He's a big part of a lot of the forums that I talk on every day on Facebook. There's some like a part of like 20 of them, so
it's awesome. We're all going to get together and just have a nerd FPV explosion,
right?
Yes,
it's going to be awesome.
People can make fun of my NASA race quad some more.
All right, everyone, well, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Seriously, man, who are we talking to next week?
I'll tell you later.
All right, see y'all.
See you, everyone.
See ya.